Our guest this hour is the author of How to Be a Muslim, an American Story. Good morning, I'm Joy Cardine. You're listening to the Ideas Network. Our guest will describe the pressures of living in a country that often shuns and fears Muslims. He also shares his own complicated relationship with Islam and his battles with a mental illness. And we will welcome your questions for him and perhaps your own experiences of being Muslim in America today. 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to ideas@wpr.org. You can also post on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page or tweet us at Joy Cardine Show. Let me welcome our guest. Haroon Mogal is a fellow in Jewish-Muslim relations at the Shalom Hartman Institute. He is author of the book, How to Be a Muslim, An American Story. Good morning.
Morning. How are you?
I'm good. Thanks for being with us. So do you think how to be a Muslim is a common question that many Muslims in America are struggling to understand today?
Probably the most common question we ask ourselves. One of the ironies, I think, of the present moment is that a lot of Americans are curious to know who's a Muslim, whether that's for the sake of a travel ban or just trying to understand the community. And I think you've got some folks who wonder whether anyone should be a Muslim, but for people who are actually Muslim, who practice the faith or who were just born into the faith, that's probably the single most important question, which is, what does it mean to live out our religion in the present circumstance?
Well, we will go into that in a little bit more depth, but let's step back and talk about your upbringing first. You grew up in New England, in Massachusetts, in a very traditional Pakistani-American Muslim home. Give us an idea of how your upbringing shaped you.
My family was actually unique in that we were not traditionally Pakistani. I think what made our family different was that my mom came from, I guess for lack of a better term, it was almost like being a minister's son or a reverend's son. My mom came from a very religiously educated family. Mm-hmm. So we didn't do things simply because they were cultural practices, which a lot of people who come from more traditional homes do. We did things because we had a religious argument behind them for them, which made things very different growing up. Because unlike a lot of Muslims, I was pretty well versed in my religion, and that made it all the harder to rebel against it, precisely because it was so overwhelming and so consuming. And it contrasted pretty starkly to the world around me. Like you said, I was born in New England. I was raised in two towns, one in Massachusetts and one in Connecticut, that were very pleasant towns and very nice places to live, and people were very friendly. But they were very homogenous towns. There were almost, for example, no non-Christian students in my high school. And so for me, probably the starkest divide was between what I lived at home and the world I moved through and wanted to be a part of outside of the home, especially at school, and trying to make sense of those two, which was really hard given how different they were.
Mm-hmm. And you said it made it hard to rebel, but yet you did rebel. Tell us about that.
I did. The rebellion started with Green Day, in case anyone hasn't heard of Green Day. It's
yes.
a punk rock band from
yes.
the Bay Area.
Uh-huh.
Been around for quite a while. I remember, I don't know if anyone remembers MTV, but MTV was this thing in the 90s, and they'd play music videos, and my tastes in music until then were pretty innocuous. And for some reason, there was a Green Day single called Geek Stink Breath from their second major album. It was called Insomniac. And for some reason, I absolutely loved the song, and I would listen to the music video as often as I could whenever I had the chance. It just absolutely captivated me. And so I made my mom drive me to a music store. I think nobody remembers what those are either.
Mm-hmm.
But I drove to a music store to buy the album. And I remember picking up the CD and unwrapping it on the drive home. And it's not the easiest song to understand, especially if you're not used to punk rock, so I couldn't really follow all the lyrics. And at one point, Billy Joe Armstrong, the lead singer, he rhymes methamphetamine with steam.
Oh, boy.
And I didn't know what that was.
Yeah.
I just knew it was probably very taboo. And that was the moment when it kind of occurred to me that the things I was interested in were very different than the things I was raised to believe I should be interested in. And music really set me on the road to try to figure out a different path for myself.
Yeah. And how did your mother, how did your family react to this?
Fortunately, they never read the lyrics, so yeah. They probably just thought I was listening to terrible music. And I think that's a pretty common sentiment between parents and children. They generally avoided my taste in music. My father didn't even listen to music at all. My mom was from a much more creative family, so although we didn't necessarily always share the same taste in music, we did share some taste in music. She surprisingly really liked Eddie Vedder. His singing reminded her of a style of singing in South Asia, so we had these areas of overlap. I was a Star Trek fan, she was a Star Trek fan. But broadly speaking, I think my parents were worried by the way in which I was changing, probably scared about it, and upset about it as well, because it seemed to represent either a rejection of what they stood for or the pursuit of a lifestyle that they couldn't approve of.
Yeah. And you also mentioned that, I think you said being a Muslim, or at least the practice in your home, was overwhelming. How was that overwhelming?
A lot of my friends who are Pakistani grew up in households where they were told to do things simply because that's how they were done. A lot of my friends who are Pakistani were told that they had to marry someone who is not just of Pakistani origin, but from the same province or even the same village, which I guess isn't that bad in the Pakistani case because there's still hundreds of millions of you. But it's still pretty limiting if you're growing up in suburbia and suddenly your romantic life choices have been reduced to possibly one person in 500 square miles. My parents, on the other hand, never told me that I had to do something because that's just what people did. They would be able to produce arguments based on religious text or religious law. And that, in some ways, that was a good thing. They never, for example, held a belief that I would have to marry someone from my own culture or ethnicity. They saw that as kind of a benighted way of looking at the world and not religiously sanctioned. And religion was supposed to be universal, and so we should be universal. But on other occasions, it was just really hard because you weren't just rebelling against what your parents are saying. You'd have to rebel against 1,400 years of religious tradition, which you were being educated in. So it was overwhelming because it was very hard to find room for myself personally and even for my own religious identity because everything seemed to be taken up by my parents the way that they were religious.
Talk some about where were you on September 11th and how that changed everything?
On September 11th, I was going to class at NYU. I was getting out of the subway down on Prince Street in Soho, probably 10 minutes after the first tower was hit. And so when I got out, I remember people were standing on the sidewalk, craning their necks, looking up. And the gesture was very unusual because people in New York, unless they're tourists, do not look up. Yeah. And the worst thing you can be in New York is a tourist. So I was a little bit confused, and then I saw that there was a hole in the tower and there was smoke pouring out. And I asked someone what had happened. And I don't know if it was a man or a woman. Honestly, the day is such an overwhelming memory. And they said that a plane had hit the tower. And I probably, like a lot of Americans, especially if they didn't see what was happening on TV, I assumed at first that it was an accident, a horrible, terrible, but nevertheless entirely accidental accident. And
right.
I also assumed it was a small plane, like a private plane. I mean, never in my wildest dreams would I have imagined that, you know, it doesn't make any sense, right? Why would a passenger plane of that size accidentally hit a skyscraper? And so, nevertheless, it was so far beyond the realm of possibility that I went to class thinking, you know, that's unfortunate, but that'll be taken care of. And then when I got to class, actually, we were in the basement of a building called the Kevorkian Center in Washington Square Park. It's the Middle Eastern Studies building, which is relevant for what comes next. And a student came downstairs and said the second tower had been hit. And that's when it took all of us just a few seconds to kind of process this is not an accident and that something far more pernicious and malicious is going on. For me, the immediate conclusion was that it was Al-Qaeda, that this was a terrorist attack by that specific group, because there was no one else. I was a Middle Eastern Studies major, and I followed politics in the Middle East and Muslim world very closely, and there was no one else that it could have been. I mean, I know initially, if you remember, I think the first group that was held responsible was the Popular Front for the Liberation of Palestine, which is a Marxist movement. And I remember hearing that and thinking there's no way that movement would be in any way involved. They had no interest in striking the United States, and anyhow, none of the capacity. So I knew it was bin Laden, it was al-Qaeda. That was pretty obvious. And then the second thought that occurred to me was, here I am in New York City, and I'm president of the largest Muslim community within proximity of Ground Zero that is at all, that has a public profile of any kind. I'm a Middle Eastern studies major. And not only am I scared because we're living through a terrorist attack, but I'm also scared because I'm wondering if there's going to be a backlash.
We are talking with the author of How to Be a Muslim, An American Story, about his experiences growing up as a Muslim in America. And we are welcoming your questions. We are welcoming your own experiences. 1-800-642-1234, or send an email to ideas@wpr.org. You can also post on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page or tweet us at Joy Cardine Show. Our guest is Haroon Mogel, the fellow in Jewish-Muslim relations at the Shalom Hartman Institute and author of the book, How to Be a Muslim. Just before news time, we were talking, Haroon, about the 9/11 terrorist attacks. You were president of the Islamic Center at New York University, and you were saying how you felt frightened that the country was under a terrorist attack, but also were frightened that there was going to be a backlash against Muslims because al-Qaeda was likely responsible. You also felt pushed into the spotlight as a Muslim spokesperson for interfaith audiences, and you said that you felt like a total fraud. Tell us more about that.
I was 21 when it happened, and being in this role, when I got involved at the Islamic Center at NYU, it was a student club, and the whole idea was you have some activities, you get some free pizza, you have some conversations, you meet people, and I mean that's it, right? It's a student club. It's not really designed to be a launching pad to be at the center of this major international conversation. And yet, in the weeks and months after 9/11, I was doing dozens of interviews with, I mean, everyone from Brazilian newspapers to Japanese newspapers, and I don't even remember half the interviews I gave or what I even said. And I felt like a fraud for two reasons. On the one hand, I wasn't even that religious, and I was involved in the Islamic Center because I found I liked and I was actually pretty good at community organizing. And so I put myself in that work even as I wondered if that was the right place for me to be as someone who wasn't that religious. But I also felt like a fraud because now I was standing up at audiences with priests and ministers and rabbis and talking about religion and extremism and violence. And I'm a 21-year-old kid, and I'm talking alongside religious professionals for whom this work is, you know, it's stuff they've specialized in, and it's their bread and butter. And it was this very overwhelming feeling of, what am I doing here? Why am I in this conversation? And yet also feeling like I can't exit the conversation because how can I shirk that responsibility at a time when the entire country and even a lot of the planet is trying to figure out what's going on? To walk away from that spotlight felt like a betrayal of some kind of very deep civic and patriotic obligation.
Yeah. So how did that 9/11 shape your life?
I don't think it's ever stopped shaping our lives. If you're a Muslim in the United States, we have lived in a kind of permanent state of emergency and war as a country, and it's a war that's often framed as a battle between Islam and the West. Even people who are very well-meaning in their intentions nevertheless reproduce this kind of trope that this is some kind of civilizational conflict. And if you happen to share the religion of the people that, or some of the people that we're at war with, which is the case, then you feel yourself constantly under suspicion. Now, ironically, if Islamophobia was really about terrorism, then it would have spiked after 9/11 and declined since, because we are now at a point of country where you are more likely to be killed because someone thinks you're Muslim than by a Muslim. which is completely counterintuitive and contrary to the way in which terrorism is portrayed in the media. The spike in Islamophobia has actually came about in the last 6 or 7 years, primarily because of, one, the election of Barack Obama, which opened the floodgates to a wave of anti-Muslim, anti-Jewish, anti-Black, and basically anti-everything American hate groups. And the second is this concerted effort on the part of a lot of media outlets, deliberately or not, to conflate small groups of terrorists with a much larger threat, which created a sense of panic among many Americans. And so hence you have an environment where you're more likely to be killed because someone thinks you're Muslim than by a Muslim terrorist. And yet that reality goes almost completely unreported in the media.
Yeah. You intentionally wanted to write a book that's not political. Why?
Well, there's so many of those books already. I mean, you can go into the bookstore and go to the Islam section, and pretty much all you will find is either books on why Islam is the worst religion ever. And this makes the Islam section very unique among religion sections, because it's either why Islam is the worst thing ever or some kind of book about Islam and violence. And since a lot of people have written those books, I didn't really see what the point was to add another. And because there's some of those books are quite good, some of them are not, some of them are. But I just wanted to tell my own story. Mm-hmm. And it's my story. It's not anyone else's story. So I'm not pretending that I'm speaking to a universal experience. But from the responses I've gotten from people, a lot of people say that they see themselves and hear themselves and feel themselves mirrored, which tells me that it was an important story to tell, because it's explaining that Muslims are human beings is somehow a subversive act and a radical act, and not enough people are doing it, and not enough people in the U.S. and in a lot of other places have access to those kinds of stories. And so it's easy in a country where Muslims are 1% of the population for us to be turned into this, nebulous, terrifying fifth column. And so I wanted to write a story that shows that we're not all about politics or violence or extremism, that those things are usually tangential to our lives, and that we struggle with the same stuff that anyone else does.
Yeah. And that noted, the politics of today certainly does play a role in the lives of Muslims in America, yes?
Absolutely. It's inescapable. And I came of age in the Clinton years. So, I don't know where listeners are in terms of their experience of America, but I think who the president is kind of determines what your shape of the country is or your sense of American politics is. And probably the biggest crisis in American politics in the 1990s was Monica Lewinsky, which is amazing to think about right now, yeah, given where we are as a country and how much more heated and fractious our politics have become. And so for me, default America is at some level still pre-9/11. It's the optimism of the 90s. It's the sense that we are, could be, the world's unchallenged superpower. And for Muslims now, I mean, this is kind of like whiplash. For Muslims who are a little bit older, Barack Obama is your default America, which has got to be really interesting, because your default America is a Black president who's of immigrant and Muslim origin. And then now, for Muslims who are coming of age, Donald Trump is your picture of America and what America is supposed to be. I mean, that not only sets the bar really low for president, but it means that anti-Muslim sentiment is part of the politics and platform of the country's highest office.
Yeah. And while your book does not get into politics, I did want to know how issues like the Supreme Court a ruling recently that a limited version of President Trump's travel ban can take effect as it hears the full travel ban probably in the fall. What are your thoughts? How do you feel about this country banning travel from predominantly Muslim countries, except if there is a family member or a job or a school that that the traveler is connected to?
I could answer that by referencing what it feels like to be a Muslim right now, but there's that, and that's important. But there's also a different way of answering that, which is that it scares me as an American. So I worked in national security for a while. I was in D.C. and in New York as well at a couple of think tanks, and we looked at problems of extremism. What scares me about this moment as an American is that it doesn't seem like anyone is in charge of the country. Trump has proven himself to be an absolutely terrible manager of people. So his administration is leaking left, right, and center. He has almost no control over his subordinates. He's left critical posts unfilled. He's gone to war with our intelligence agencies. It seems plausible to argue that many of our intelligence agencies seem that he is somehow in collusion with the Russians and therefore not to be trusted, which is unprecedented as far as I can remember, that an American president would be seen as too dangerous and too unstable for critical information to be shared with, which means that the country has no head and no center. And so these agencies are running on autopilot. And many of the people who are at these agencies, I'm sure, know how to run on autopilot. They can figure it out. They're competent individuals. They're professionals. But it makes you wonder who is actually protecting the country right now. Because if you have an organization that has no one in charge, then inevitably you're going to have gaps and you're going to have pieces that go missing. And so what concerns me about the travel ban isn't just how it makes me feel as Muslim, it's how it makes me feel as an American. And as an American, it makes me feel like we have political theater instead of actual policies to make the country safer. President Trump's first and so far only substantial visit abroad was to Saudi Arabia and later to Israel, and then he went to Europe. But that trip in Saudi Arabia, he promised a continuation of a policy that basically doubles down on supporting the country that is probably the largest driver of extremism in the world in order to fight extremism. The travel ban is just theater. It's red meat he's throwing to his followers to do two things. One is to pretend like he's actually doing something about terrorism when he's actually funding the people who are funding terrorism, which kind of amounts to the same thing if you think about it. And the other is that he's packed his administration with billionaires, and he's pursuing policies that not only don't help his base or the average American, but actually undermine them. So this is all political theater. It's a nice game by which it makes it look like he's acting tough and he's doing things that Obama would refuse to do. But he's not actually doing anything of substance. What actually stops extremists is careful vetting and looking at people beyond simple categories. I mean, in the last few years, ISIS recruitment in the United States has dropped considerably, in part because of the success of the war against ISIS. A good percentage of the folks who joined ISIS from the United States when their recruitment was at its peak were not even born Muslim. And they didn't even convert to Islam in an ordinary sense. They were radicalized online and converted to Islam online. Banning people randomly from six countries does absolutely nothing to protect us from a significant percentage of ISIS recruits who are everyday Americans who converted to ISIS online. So these are the kinds of policies that, you know, if you don't actually know anything about the problem, maybe make you feel better. But if you know anything about the problem, make you wonder, well, if this isn't making us safer, why would you do it?
As an American, what's your reaction to the latest headline in the news that President Trump has canceled the annual iftar dinner to commemorate Ramadan, the end of Ramadan? CNN reports that this was done for the first time in nearly two decades. Instead of hosting the dinner at the White House, President Trump and First Lady Melania released a statement wishing warm greetings to those celebrating Eid al-Fitr. Your reaction to that?
The Eid dinner that the office of the president usually holds, and this is something that President Bush did and President Obama did, it actually started, Hillary Clinton brought the practice back after a very long time. I think the previous dinner before the 90s was by Thomas Jefferson. Mm-hmm. So it kind of fell by the wayside for a little while there. The dinner has basically two types of guests. One are prominent American Muslim leaders in a variety of fields, not just religious leaders, people in healthcare and technology and medicine and what have you. And then the other kind of group of guests are ambassadors, diplomats, and functionaries from Muslim-majority countries. And so the dinner is an important chance for the president to communicate that relations with Americans who are Muslim are important, just like relationships with other kinds of Americans are important. So on the one hand, this is very disturbing because he shows no interest when there's terrorism against Muslims. He is, I mean, just crickets from him. So he doesn't care about us. That's very clear. And he actually actively wants to hurt us, which is a little bit alarming. And then second, when he's ignoring an event or deliberately canceling an event that is aimed at building relationships with Muslim-majority countries, it makes me wonder, it's just petty. I mean, we have American soldiers fighting right now, risking their lives to fight groups like ISIS. And in many cases, they're fighting alongside Muslim troops, right? So we've got Americans who are aiding Iraqi forces, who are aiding Syrian rebel forces, including Kurdish forces. And they're there on the front lines. Afghanistan is the same thing. We have Americans who have relationships with, obviously, other countries in the region. We have a huge base in Qatar. And basically, we're saying to those countries, well, you know, your religion, your culture aren't even important enough for us to have a dinner in your honor. It really takes nothing to put a dinner on for the White House. Maybe this White House would find it a little bit more challenging, but nevertheless, it's not that hard. And it's basically communicating a message, which is, we don't care about you. And you wonder why, if the goal is to actually fight terrorism, and this connects to the last question you asked, which is, I mean, it's totally on point. It seems like he doesn't actually want to fight terrorism. He wants to talk about terrorism, but he doesn't actually want to do what it takes to get us to a point where we are all safer from it.
We have just a couple of minutes before news break, and then we'll get back to your story and your book. But what is it that you think can be done to make us all safe?
So for me, there's a lot of pieces that go missing here. Obviously, a significant component of this is intelligence work. It's the military. It's literally doing what it takes to find, to uncover, and to stop terrorists. And that should be obvious and evident to anyone. And we can quibble about strategy and things like that, but obviously you need to do what it takes to keep America safe. But beyond that, we seem to have no strategy for what victory looks like or how to get there. And so we've kind of put our military in a holding pattern where we kill terrorists at a rate slower than we produce them. And so we seem to have entered now this weird phase of permanent war. The war in Afghanistan is the longest war in U.S. history, and it seems no closer to resolution, and really have no idea what we're doing there. And the Iraq war was a completely unnecessary and immoral conflict. There was no reason for us to put our troops on the ground there or to ask them to fight in a war that has no clear objective, right? So this is not about the military. This is about civilian control of the military and a failure of civilian leadership. Because, no matter how qualified and competent your military, if you don't have a clear objective, then nobody's going to be able to win a war when nobody even knows what winning means. And so we've basically entered this point where we don't have any larger strategy or vision. And what I would say is one of the things we need to do is actually to invest in countries in the region that aren't hotbeds of extremism, because right now our policy is all security, security, security. We should be investing in countries that have figured out how to build inclusive politics, because just in the same way, and I'll end here, the same way that Syria, the vacuum in Syria, sucks in countries around it, and instability sucks in countries around it, and spreads instability, stability and prosperity do the same thing. So when a country's got it right, it then, the effects that spill over and benefit countries around them, and we're not doing that. We're focused only on the threats and not on the opportunity.
We will check news, and then we'll be back, and we'll continue our conversation with Haroon Mogal, author of How to Be a Muslim, An American Story. You're listening to the Ideas Network. I'm Joy Cardine. We are talking with the author of How to Be a Muslim, An American Story. Haroon Mogal is the fellow in Jewish-Muslim relations at the Shalom Hartman Institute. And in the book, he talks about what it was like growing up and the pressures of living in a country that shuns and fears Muslims in many cases, his own complicated relationship with Islam, and his battles with a mental illness, which we haven't got into yet, and we will now. And we will welcome your questions for him. We'll also welcome your own experiences. Are you a Muslim in Wisconsin, or are you listening from another state? Do you have an experience you'd like to share? 1-800-642-1234, or send an email to ideas@wpr.org. Or do you have a question for our guest about his observations and his thoughts on some of the current politics? We'll welcome those as well. 1-800-642-1234, or send an email to ideas@wpr.org. I'm going to start with, before we get into your story again, Haroon, with Gary on Facebook, who says, it's tough to be apolitical when you define yourself with a political identity group, and that's it. What's your reaction to that? That you identify
with? There's a common, there's a common theme out there, which is rather pernicious and dangerous, that Islam isn't a religion, it's a political identity. It's very much not the case. Islam is no more, no less political than other major religions in the world. Christianity, Judaism, and so for most Muslims, politics is not part of their religious or spiritual identity. For me, it's been important, politics, as an American, given the work that I do, but that's not the experience of most American Muslims that I know of, who tend, like any other American, to be kind of disillusioned by politics, probably not too involved. Although these days, given the nature of the conversations we're having, if you're Muslim or you're a minority or immigrant origin or African-American, like most Muslims, then you do kind of have to be a little bit more checked in than other people do.
Yeah. Post or around 9/11, you were being a devout Muslim in public, but yet in private, you considered yourself an atheist?
Well, not at the point of 9/11. I had gone through a period of atheism when I was in high school. It wasn't an atheism of conviction. It was an atheism of convenience, because the easiest way to rebel against a religious identity was to reject the religious identity altogether. But one thing I did, I found, is that my identity was very different from what I thought a religious person was supposed to be. And I didn't know how to come to terms with this. I'm sure a lot of us, when we're younger, a lot less comfortable with ourselves, don't really know what to do when who we are inside is different from what people want us to be outside. And because I really enjoyed the work I was doing with Muslim communities, and I really appreciated the chance to be part of a diverse and growing community, I hid those doubts, and I knew how to play a public role as someone who checked all the boxes for what a quote-unquote good Muslim is supposed to be. And that feeling of deception and fraud weighed very, very heavily on me.
Yeah. What made you come back to Islam?
For me, it was an experience in Saudi Arabia where I was at the tomb of the Prophet Muhammad in the city of Medina. And I remembered some of my favorite stories from his life, and I realized that if I were to leave Islam altogether or leave religion altogether, then I not only wouldn't have a connection to that, but I would have to call the Prophet a kind of fraud or a liar, and I couldn't bring myself to do that. And it was a really important moment for me, and I think for anyone who goes through a spiritual journey, is that moment when you find something in your particular tradition that resonates as true with you. And it's not from your parents. It's not from popular culture. It's not from the preacher at the pulpit. It's yours. And for me, that was mine. And that was the first thing I found in Islam that I felt like belonged to me. And that's what I built my relationship to Islam on. And that's what keeps me going, especially when, as I'm sure you can imagine, it's not the easiest thing in the world to be Muslim, given what some Muslims do in the name of Islam. And so you do need that kind of internal connection.
You I believe after graduating from NYU, you began experiencing some extreme panic attacks, and you were later diagnosed with bipolar disorder. Describe how this affected you.
For listeners who don't know what it's like to be Pakistani-American, you're basically expected to be a doctor. There's no other career path that's acceptable. Maybe number two is engineering, but there's a clear hierarchy. So you should be a doctor, and if you can't be a doctor, you won't be a doctor, then you can be an engineer. Those are the only two professions. And I was not going to pursue either of them because I was no good at either of them, and I wasn't particularly interested in either of them. So I decided to go to law school, and that was at least socially acceptable within Pakistani-American circles. So I went to law school, and I was absolutely miserable, and I had this sinking feeling that if I didn't succeed in law school, then I would, and this is amazing to think about now, that there was literally nothing I could do, and there were no professions out there for me, and I was going to die homeless and alone. Mm. And I remember having this meltdown in my dorm, which was a panic attack. I didn't know what a panic attack was. I thought it was like the end of the world or something like that. Yeah. And then a few months later, after I dropped out of law school, I remember I was driving home from a trip to New York, and I was in my parents' car, and I was alone, and I saw an overpass. I was on the highway, and I thought suddenly of driving my car into the concrete pillars holding up the overpass. And then I realized that I actually wanted to do it. And that's when I reached out to a family friend who was a psychiatrist, and I told her because I knew that was not normal. And she told me the next day after talking to me for a few hours that I was bipolar. And this completely shattered me, first because I thought what I was going through was completely unusual and specific to me. So I had no idea what to make of this idea that other people went through this and that this was a common thing and that this was a treatable thing. But also I had picked up the idea that mental illness was not something that Muslims were supposed to believe in. And I'm sure part of this is religion, part of this is culture. Part of this is being a child of immigrants. And I think even in popular American culture, there's still a hesitation to believe that you can't just fix yourself, that you can't just lift yourself up by your bootstraps, so to speak. And so I felt like I had just been handed this kind of spiritual death sentence, that I was told that there was something so wrong with me religiously that I had mental illness, which I could only interpret as some kind of proof of God's hatred of me.
Yeah. And because you thought, too, that this was maybe punishment because you were questioning your faith?
Absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely. That this was God's belated reaction to my insufficient piousness.
Yeah. And so what, do you have any advice for other Muslims who might might share similar experiences in terms of mental illness?
For anyone who's going through it, my first piece of advice is that you have to take it seriously. I think a lot of people try to brush it off and assume that it's not a big deal, but it is a big deal, and it's not normal, and it's not healthy when you start thinking about killing yourself.
Right.
That's something that needs attention. The second thing is that you have to care about yourself enough to want attention, which is kind of the paradox of mental illness. It makes you, like, if you're depressed, you don't think you're worthy of help. And that's the difference between being depressed and having a broken bone. In both cases, something is physically wrong, and it's causing you pain. But a broken bone doesn't make you think that you don't deserve to be treated for the broken bone, whereas depression makes you think that you don't deserve treatment or that treatment is impossible. And so it's a really tough spot to be in because you don't think that you should be treated or that you deserve it. And so you have to put yourself in a place where you take it seriously and that you're willing to handle it and that you understand that it's going to take a lot of time and effort. And one of the most important things, honestly, is to surround yourself with people who can get you there. So people who push you to be better and to be safer and to be healthier. And that can be a religious leader, that can be friends and family, that can be a spiritual practice, a social circle. But you have to have something in your life, especially when you're down on yourself, that pushes you to out of that negativity.
You wrote, to be a Muslim today is to be disappointed, frustrated, and even scared. We are 1.6 billion people who can't seem to make a mark on the world worthy of our numbers, our histories, our ideas. Why is that, and do you see that changing?
Why it is a really big question that probably every Muslim goes to sleep at night thinking about. If you go down the street and ask the average person what the first word is that comes to mind when they hear Islam,
yeah,
I'm pretty sure you can guess the answer.
Terrorism, probably.
And, yeah, and that's something that we have to live with. And that doesn't mean that, therefore, every Muslim is at fault for what some Muslims do. But it also doesn't mean that we can stick our head in the sand and pretend that it has nothing to do with our religion. These groups believe themselves to be religious. I don't know if every single terrorist is motivated by religion. In many cases, they're actually not. They go through these radical, abrupt conversions to people who have lived a life of petty crime, abuse, alcoholism, and then suddenly they quote-unquote find God, who, you know, a God who tells them to go kill people. It's a little bit convenient and strange. But the recruitment and the thinkers, if I can call them that, behind this movement profess themselves religious. And so they call themselves things like the Islamic State, or, you know, Al-Qaeda, which sees itself as a Muslim movement.
And forgive me, we have less than a minute to go. Do you have a takeaway for our listeners who are with us?
Yeah, I think if you get to know the American Muslim community, you'll meet some very remarkable people who are doing amazing things. And that requires stepping beyond the headlines and meeting Muslims where they are. And you'll find out that they're doing very, very incredible things for their country and their community.
Thank you so much for being with us. Haroon Mogal is author of How to Be a Muslim, an American Story. Thanks to Nyasia Ellison for producing the program. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network.